पाल प्रणाम से परिवराज कचारे स्तरां से शुमारे गंगेश बल्कि सिद्धांत सरस्वती पिता को प्रभुपाद की जाए ग्रंथ राज श्रीमद भागवतम की जाए समवेद भक्त ब्रह्म की जाए गौबरी मनंदी ग्लोरी श्री सम डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरी श्री सम डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरी श्री सम डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरी श्री श्री गुरु एंड श्री गौरांग ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So, reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 10th canto, chapter 76, the battle between Shalva and the Vrishnis. We're on text 28, and we're going to read until the end of the chapter, text 33. So, we'll chant the Sanskrit of text 28, and then we'll read the English for the other verses.
Labdha, Samgyo, Muhyatena Karshni Saratim Abravit Aho Asadi Idam Sutta Yad Pranam Me Apasarpanam Labda Samgyo Muhyatena Karshni Saratima Bravit Aho Asadav Idam Sutta Yadranan Mepasharpanam Labda Sangyo Muhurtena Karshni Saratima Bravit Aho asavidam sutta yadranam me pasarpanam labda samgyo muhurtena karshni saratima bravit Aho asavidam sutta yadranam me pasarpanam
Someone else, please.
Labda, attaining. Samgya, consciousness. Muhurtena, in a moment. Karshni, the son of Lord Krishna. Saratim to his chariot driver. Abravit said, Aho, Asadu, improper. Idam, this. Suta, or driver. Yat, which. Ranat, from the battlefield. Me, my. Apasarpanam, being taken away. Translation. Quickly regaining consciousness, Lord Krishna's son, Pradyumna, said to his charioteer, O driver, this is abominable for me to have been removed from the battlefield. So, then text 29. Except for me, no one born in the Yadu dynasty has ever been known to abandon the battlefield. My reputation has now been stained by a driver who thinks like a eunuch. What will I say to my fathers, Rama and Keshava, when I return to them after having simply fled the battle? What can I tell them that will befit my honor? Purport. Sri Pradyumna here uses the word Pitaro, fathers, loosely. Lord Balaram was, of course, his uncle. Certainly, my sisters-in-law will laugh at me and say, O hero, tell us how in the world your enemies turn you in such a coward in battle. The driver replied, O long-lived one, I have done this knowing full well my prescribed duty. O my lord, the chariot driver must protect the master on the chariot when he is in danger, and the master must also protect his driver. With this rule in mind, I remove you from the battlefield, since you had been struck unconscious by your enemy's club, and I thought you were seriously injured. Thus ends the purport of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, Srila Siddhanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 10th canto, 76th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Battle Between Shalva and the Vishnus. Om Adhyanata Milanda Syagiran Jala Shalakaya. So, going back a bit about Shalva, Keshava Prabhu, when he was giving class, he was mentioning a little bit how we hear of Shalva first in the Mahabharata in regards to Bhishma going and kidnapping Amba, Ambika, and Ambalika. Because his Vichitavirya at that time had gone to a certain age, and Bhishma felt that he wasn't ready enough to fight all the kshatriyas who had gathered around the Swayambhar ceremony of those three girls getting married. So he came personally, and of course, when they saw him, they weren't very happy. They kind of understood what he was coming to do, and he just grabbed those three girls and took off. And with some opposing elements, some of them fought, and especially Shalva, because Amba was the one who had offered her heart to Shalva, and had garlanded him. But in the, you know, in that situation, she didn't feel that she could express herself to Bhishma. She was so overtaken by the whole thing that she didn't express anything. And although Shalva tried to fight against Bhishma, he was no match. So finally, Bhishma took off. And only when he arrived in Hastinapur and things were a little bit more calm, then Ambika expressed that she had already given her heart to Shalva. So with proper due respect, Bhishma had her accompanied by military people in a royal process and back to Shalva. But he refused her. So, of course, obviously that created more enmity for Shalva against the Pandavas and so forth. And on Krishna's side, we hear about Shalva. Of course, we know that Kamsa, hearing that he would be killed by the eighth son of Devaki, and knowing that he was Kalanemi in his past life, that Narada Muni, when he visited, told him that. So he was very much against Lord Krishna, and he tried so many ways to kill him, and he sent so many demons. there, but finally, not succeeding, he finally got Akura to go to Vrindavan and invite Krishna to Mathura. And Krishna accepted that. One of the reasons is described that he accepted that is that Krishna, of course, he killed so many demons, and he was always cheered, and all the inhabitants of Vrindavan were very happy when Krishna would kill demons, but they're always thinking that somehow Krishna had managed to do that by the help of some demigod or maybe some sages or Mother Yasoda's prayers, chanting some mantras. It wasn't really Krishna himself that did this. And Krishna was feeling that every time these demons come, they just create such a disturbance in the peaceful atmosphere of Vrindavan. And the cowherd boys and the cowherd men and so forth, the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they're always wondering what to do next. Because, okay, Krishna, now this demon's been killed, but obviously some other demon will come. And we know that they finally left Gokul and they went to Nandagram to kind of set themselves somewhere else to avoid the demons coming and disturbing them. So Krishna was thinking that if I leave Vrindavan, the only reason they're coming is to get me. So if I leave Vrindavan, then there'll be a peaceful atmosphere created in Vrindavan, and at least the inhabitants, my parents, so forth, will leave a more peaceful environment. So therefore, he went to Mathura. And of course, the whole thing in Mathura is kind of a little bit like Duryodhana did with Yudhisthira. Nah, just come for a friendly game. We'll just play a little game of dice, right? It was just a friendly thing, just enjoying a little bit of enjoyment, entertainment here. But he has stacked the whole thing with Shakuni. And later, you know, when Yudhisthira agreed, he was like, well, actually, I'm not going to play this. My uncle's going to do it for me. So it was somewhat of a similar arrangement that Krishna was to go to Mathura and see his uncle Kamsa and so forth and be entertained by fighting with a few wrestlers. But when they finally, and the inhabitants of Vrindavan went there and all sitting and they're all waiting for this entertainment to take place. But when they see all these big wrestlers coming and the little small Krishna and Balaram, they're thinking, what have we done? What are we doing here? This is not auspicious at all. This is ridiculous. How we can be entertain ourselves with this? I mean, so they're all puzzled. Like, what are we doing here? And of course, Krishna finally kills the wrestlers. And whatever other wrestlers are there, they take off. And of course, Kamsa is so confident of himself that he's already entertained the whole thing, that, you know, the wrestlers will kill Krishna, and he's got a musical arrangement, and everyone will cheer, and the music will be on. But Krishna uses against Kamsa, and the music starts playing, and Krishna starts dancing, and he's in the arena dancing, and he's inviting all the coward boys to come and dance with him. And Kamsa's like, infuriated, what is this? I'm a buffoon here. I mean, you know, this whole thing is flipped against me. So he starts screaming and telling the guards to stop the music and then to kill Nanda and Ugrasen and arrest all everyone from Vrindavan. It's a whole thing. So then Krishna decides, okay, I got to wipe this guy out. So he rushes into where Kamsa is sitting, grabs him, drags him down in the arena and finishes him off. Now, Kamsa's two wives, Asti and Prati, they were Jarasandha's daughters. So, of course, they're disturbed. Their husband's been killed. So after the whole ceremony, they go running to Jarasandha, their father, to tell him, listen, this is what happened. We're widows now. Our husband's been killed by Krishna. So in a rage, Jarasandha decides to attack Mathura. And he gets assisted by Shishupal and Shalva, who, excuse me, I got a little bit of a cold here, who participates in that. And we know Jarasandha attacked Mathura 18 times. Now, in the beginning, at one point, Balaram arrests Jarasandha, and they've got him. But Krishna says, okay, release him, because Jarasandha will come back and bring more demons and we can wipe out all these demons. But after 18 times, then Krishna decides that this is too much for the poor inhabitants of Mathura. I mean, they're living through this, right? So he decides him and Balaram to go. And they go to a mountain and they seemingly hide in a cave. And Jarasandha and his army is running after them and he can't find them there. So he sets that hill on fire. And of course, Krishna and Balaram, they leave there. And Jarasandha thinks, okay, I've killed them. They burnt in the fire. This coward of Krishna, right? Remember that Jarasandha considered Krishna a coward. And we'll see that a little later. So then Krishna finally goes to Dwarka, because he thinks, if I go there, finally the inhabitants of Mathura will be in peace. And there is seemingly some kind of peaceful atmosphere for a while, because Jarasandha thinks that Krishna is dead. And Balaram. So that situation is going on. Now, meanwhile, in Indraprastha, we know Duryodhana is doing all this thing against the Pandavas and so forth. And one day Krishna, after setting Dwarka in place, he goes to Hastinapur because he's aware of the atrocities that are going on there. So he goes there to pacify the Pandavas somewhat. And he goes with Arjuna one day to hunt in the Kandava forest. And Agni comes up to Krishna and tells him, I've lost all my Shakti. He's like sick, right? He's got no more potency. And he wants to devour the Kandava forest to get all the herbs and everything, but he's afraid of Indra. So he's requesting Krishna to please protect me, right, from the onslaught of Indra. So Krishna protects Agni. He swallows the forest and burns it all, because Agni, the demigod of fire. But there's a demon in that forest, Maya, who gets stuck in the forest, in the fire, and Arjuna and Krishna saves him. So, being saved, he wants to offer some service. And Krishna and Arjuna said, well, we don't need anything, but maybe Yudhisthira might need your help. So then he builds the whole kingdom, in the Prastha kingdom, for Yudhisthira. And we know how it was an amazing place, that, you know, water looked like land and land looked like water and all that. So Duryodhana, he's in Hastinapur and he's like happy like anything. They finally got rid of the Pandavas. They're in some desert somewhere, right? That's what he's thinking. He's not realizing that all this is taking place and they've built this whole kingdom for themselves. So one day Narada Muni shows up to Indraprastha, and Yudhisthira greets him. He's very happy to see Narada Muni, shows him all around. And then Narada Muni, as he normally does, instills some trouble, because everything's a little peaceful by now. So he tells Yudhisthira that you should do some Rajasuya sacrifice. This would be very good for your ancestors, even your father Pandu. So then Yudhisthira thinks, yeah, that's maybe I should do that. So he consults Krishna about this idea. And Krishna says, it's a very good idea, but you won't accomplish it as long as Jarasandha is alive. So that's when Krishna decides to play this trick. He doesn't want to go with a whole army. So he says, okay, Arjuna, Bhima, myself will disguise ourselves as Brahmins. And Jarasandha was a little bit like Bali. He was very favorable to the Brahmins and so forth. We know the story of Vamanadeva and all that. So they go to Jarasandha. And Jarasandha receives them, they're Brahmins and so forth, but he looks at them and these fellows look a little strange. They don't really look like Brahmins, you know, they're all really muscular, you know, big muscles and strong and heavy belt and all that. But they say they're Brahmins, so he accepts it. But finally it's revealed that actually they've come to fight him. And so when he realizes, Jarasandha realizes that it's Arjuna and Krishna and Bhima, he sort of laughs at Arjuna, because Arjuna's like a kid for him. You know, I can't fight with you. You're no match for me. And Krishna, you're just a coward. So it'll be an insult for me to my reputation to want to fight you. But Bhima, yeah, he might be some match. He's an interesting guy. I might be tempted to fight. So, you know, we know there's a whole fight, and finally Jara was the two pieces that were put together by the witch. So finally Krishna, you know, rips a leaf and he pulls him apart and kills Jarasandha. So that's one demon that's taken care of in that way. Of course, all these killings are just enraging Shalva and enraging Shishupal and so forth and so on. And then we know the story of when Yudhisthira performs a Rajasura sacrifice, and in that sacrifice, Bhishma, finally, he's like one of the honored Kshatriya, So he makes the statement that of all this assembly, I don't find anyone qualified but Lord Krishna. And he should be the honored guest. He should be the one receiving the honors of this Rajasura sacrifice. And of course, Shishupal gets up, right? And he starts going on against Krishna. This is just a coward boy. We don't know how he became a king in Dwarka, but, you know, I mean, we know him when he was just pulling the tails of calves and being dragged in the mud and so forth. And he's just like going on and on and on. And he's such a disgraceable person that he killed his own uncle, Kamsa, and like that, right? And we know that he had the benediction that after 100 insults, that finally he would get his head cut off. So Krishna finally cuts Shishupal's head off. And and then Shishupal's brother attacks Krishna, Dandavakra. They were brothers, so he attacks Krishna, and Krishna kills him also. And finally, Shishupal here seems to be, if we follow some of the chronicle order, Shishupal's thinking, not Shishupal, I mean, Shalva is thinking, okay, I'm going to revenge all this, and I'm going to wipe out all the Vrishnis. And while Krishna is still in Hastinapur, I'm going to take off and go there and wipe out all the Vrishnis. And it's a little bit like Duryodhana was thinking, if I kidnap Krishna, then the Pandavas will be weakened and they won't have the energy to fight. So he's thinking, if I kill all the Vrishnis, Krishna will come there, see the devastation, see his own children killed and so forth, and he won't have the spirit to, and in that weakened position, I can wipe him out. And as Dravida yesterday was explaining, he creates at one point a certain illusion where Vasudev's got kidnapped, and finally he's cutting off Vasudev's head, and, you know, just to create a circumstance by which Krishna will be weakened in this, you know, and then he might wipe him out. So these are some of the circumstances that we hear and stories that we hear about Salva, and these are all beautiful pastimes and so forth, and we definitely have to thank Srila Prabhupada and the Acharyas for giving us all these different pastimes that took place thousands of years ago, and somehow by their mercy, the information has been transmitted, and they've commented on these things, and because of that, we are able to appreciate these wonderful pastimes. I remember that my first book that I received when I was just 17 years old was the Krishna book, and I started reading that Krishna book, and I got to the chapter where Krishna kills Kamsa, and coming from a Christian background, you know, God's all love and all that, I couldn't really relate to it. I just closed the book. I said, this is too much. Here's God killing, but not is he just killing, but he's dragging Kamsa all over the arena, right, making a show of this, like, you know, being proud of this act of killing. And I couldn't relate to it. But somehow, I was fascinated, because here was Srila Prabhupada describing something that God does. And we don't hear that, right? I mean, it's a Christian background. We know, okay, God's a guy there. He's sitting on the throne. He's got a big beard, and he's sending people to heaven and hell. And that's about all you know about God, someone to fear. But here was someone, you know, Srila Prabhupada, describing these extraordinary pastimes. So I was able to read a bit, and then when I met the devotees, they started explaining the philosophy, how, you know, the killing, everyone, we enjoy, I mean, there's enjoyment in killing, right? And Prabhupada gives that story of when he was a child, he went with his father, and there was a butcher who had cut a chicken's head, and that butcher's son was crying, but the butcher was enjoying the chicken running, right? So there's enjoyment. Well, if you're a demoniac, there's people hunt and all that. So, but Prabhupada explains that propensity is there in God also. It's not something, everything comes from God. But that when God kills, it's not the same as our killing. That actually those who are killed, they benefit it. They get liberation. So in that way, we can appreciate these pastimes because we've had Srila Prabhupada give us the proper understanding of these different pastimes. But for ordinary people, this is very uncomprehensible. Right? Like if you take the story of Pradyumna, who's born of Rukmini, and after 10 days, more or less, he's kidnapped by Sambhara, thrown in the ocean, and then a fish swallows him up, Then he ends up, you know, being offered to the king, and they bring the fish to the kitchen open, and then Pradyumna comes out alive. Now, that's impossible, right? Right? I mean, you can hear the news, right? We interrupt this program. It's a special bulletin. We just got this news, some baby found in the fish alive, right? And the scientific people are studying this, and they're trying to figure out how this kid didn't drown. Well, maybe the fish swallowed him too soon, and he couldn't drown, right? But he wasn't digested by the fish because the fish was killed too quick also. And maybe there was enough oxygen in this fish's stomach that the child didn't suffocate. And that's how the child... But we're investigating all this, and we'll come back to you, right? I mean, so the materialists, they can't understand these pastimes. And the yogis, the jnanis, the mayavadis, and personalists, they can't appreciate these pastimes. Well, because Krishna says the material world is a nasty place. Dukalayama shasvatam, abrahma bhuvanaloka. So why would, after describing all the hellish condition of this material world, would Krishna participate in these things? And sometimes, you know, the intellectual people say, well, God is trying to understand the suffering of humanity, or, you know, somehow through this process, he's allowing everyone to atone or to, you know, to get freed or to be free of their karma. You know, all these concocted ideas. So therefore, they reject these pastimes as, you know, mythology or, you know, fables or, you know, folk tales or stuff like that. And we know the story Prabhupada tells of the when Narada was going to Vaikuntha, and the Brahmin heard about this and the cobbler heard about this, so they both asked Narada, if you see Narayan, please ask him when we will get liberation. So he goes and he requests Narayan that I have this Brahmin and this cobbler, they want to know when will they attain liberation. So he says, well, the Brahmin will be many lives, and this cobbler will be in this life. And he says, and tell them that I was passing an elephant through the eye of a needle. So he goes back, and the Brahmin greets him and says, oh, Narada, you saw Narayan. And what was his answer? He said, well, I'm sad to say it will take many lives. No, yeah. What were you doing there? I mean, did you actually go? Yeah, so what was Narayan doing? Well, he was passing an elephant through the eye of a needle. Ah, I don't believe these stories. You know, how is that possible? So he could understand this Brahmin is going through all rituals. He's chanting mantras and all, but he doesn't really have faith in this. Well, he goes to see the cobbler, and the cobbler is saying, oh, what did the Lord say in this very life? Oh, he said, my Lord, so wonderful. But he's more interested, what was my Lord doing? Well, he was passing an elephant through the eye of a needle. Oh, my Lord is so extraordinary. So Narada's surprised. You believe this? Of course. How? Well, I see that from a small banyan seed, a huge banyan tree is grown. So from a small thing, a huge thing can grow. So from a big thing, you can go through a small thing. Right? It's not complicated. But for the devotee, he sees these things very simply. It's not complicated. Krishna killed this demon and this happened, and you know, we don't doubt. Of course, also Srila Prabhupada describes how so many great acharyas, like Vishwanath Chakravarti, Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, Sridhar Swami, I mean all these great acharyas, were they just fools and rascals that they wasted their time reading and writing commentaries on these pastimes? Lord Chaitanya? No, they were exalted person. So when you understand the level of these personalities, you realize, well, obviously if they accepted this, I mean, who am I to reject it, right? So in that way, by Srila Prabhupada's comments and Srila Prabhupada's explanation, we've developed faith in all these different pastimes, and we don't think these are just exaggerations or embellishments or any of these things. And here, in this particular pastimes, even for us as devotees, we can wonder, well, why is Pradyumna so much worried about his name and fame? I mean, he's chastising his driver here and saying, how am I going to show my face in front of Krishna Balaram when I'm like feeling like a coward? But of course, Lord Chaitanya said, Nadanam Janjanam Nasundari, Yantunara Bisunichina. So, Pratishtha, you know, name, fame, adoration is not part of our Vaishnav culture. It's not something we're aiming for. It's the very opposite. We don't want to have name and fame. But here, Pradyumna seems to want that, right? And even in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna as a means of getting him going for the battle, he says, one who's been honored, this honor is worse than death. And don't think that the people will consider that just out of compassion you haven't joined the battle. They'll think that out of cowardice, out of weakness, out of fear, that's why you're not coming and fighting. And that will be terrible for you, right? To be insulted in such a way. So he's using that as an argument. But of course, here in this pastime, we can understand that Pradyumna, just like Krishna sometimes, he plays like an ordinary person. When he's there in front of Agasura, and the cowboys are looking at Krishna and wondering, well, what will he do if we walk in Agasura's mouth and go right in? How will Krishna react? And they're anticipating Krishna's reaction. And Krishna plays along by showing bewilderment. Like, what am I going to do now? I mean, you know, they're gone in Agasura's mouth. So Krishna plays with his devotees. It's an enjoyment. So here Pradyumna is demonstrating that this is something that Kshatriyas are, it's an important thing for them. This name and fame, this Kshatriya, you know, to be a king and so forth. So he's playing that role, and to the point where even Vyasadeva is considering this important enough to write it. It's a detail that's, in one sense, not that important, but it adds to the pastime. It adds to the flavor of it. And it also demonstrates how powerful Shalva and his associates were, that they could even temporarily knock Pradyumna unconscious, where it was serious to the point where his driver pulled him out of the battle, knowing very well that this might cause some disruption, but I got to protect. That's like he's saying, this is my first duty, is to protect the one who's on the chariot. I'm the chariot driver. I got to protect, and you have to protect me. So it shows the seriousness of this pastime, how Shalva was very powerful. And it also shows that despite Pradyumna, like we were discussing yesterday, Jodhiva was saying sometimes Pradyumna is considered a jiva. Sometimes he's also considered part of Vasudeva, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, Aniruddha. So he might be a Vishnu Tattva. But it also describes later, next chapters, how Krishna actually kills Shalva. So even though these partial expansions of Krishna are there, ultimately Krishna is the ultimate of everyone. All the expansions are originally coming from Krishna, as is described in the Brahma Samhita, that Krishna is the original candle, and from that one candle, all the other candles are lit. So although they're all Vishnu Tattva, ultimately it all depends on Krishna. Krishna is the source of all incarnations. Iti chanchakala Krishna, like that verse. So it also helps us appreciate the unique position of Lord Krishna. So these are all wonderful pastimes that as devotees we can all relish, and we do relish them. And we can get absorbed in these things. And that's the end of the class. So some comments or some questions? Okay, you were first. Okay, well, you got the mic.
I was recently reading in the seventh canto, I think the tenth chapter, where Prabhupada says that Shalva achieved Sarupya liberation. Usually when Krishna kills demons, we understand that it's Sayuja. Do you have any understanding of
why it would be?
Why it would be Sarupya? He mentioned a few other demons that achieved Sarupya. And, you know, they get the same destination as a devotee.
Yeah.
So, but usually the understanding is that it's...
Yeah, they emerge in Krishna's body and then they get purified in that way. No, I wouldn't know. Maybe Pushkar might know, or other devotees. Sorry, any of the ladies might, devotee ladies might know. Some of you read a lot. No? Okay. Sorry. Next question.
Just when the chariot driver, he said that also that he was to be protected by him. So was he thinking that, you know, if you're knocked unconscious, the next thing is to kill me? Or was it, you know, that besides your duty to, my duty to protect you, your duty is to protect me? What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I think he was just expressing that, no, I'm not a eunuch, I'm not a coward, I'm not, I understand the principles of fighting, you know, the engagement of war, but I have a duty to perform, and maybe you didn't like it, but I had to do my duty, and at the time I thought that was a good idea to do. And despite knowing that maybe your name and fame might be affected through this, but that my duty. We know these, in those, I mean, it's like a different world, right? I mean, they're really duty bound. Like Bhishma, you know, he took a vow, and even though his guru, you know, Parasuram comes and tells him, no, you gotta marry Amba and all that, he's like, he fights him, and, you know, they were really, today, who keeps their word, right? I mean, you gotta sign everything on paper and get it notarized by a lawyer, and, you know, and even then you end up in court because people don't keep their word, but.
Well, my question is why he added that at the end, but his duty is also to protect him, you know, that. Is that like, because I was thinking there's a couple different ways. One, he would, the human would think that, that's right, if I was unconscious, I couldn't protect you. So that way you're protecting me, the human, to make sure that I always perform my duty to protect you too, and I wouldn't be able to do that either if I was unconscious.
It's possible that you can read like that, but it's basically, listen, we have both roles. You got to protect me. I mean, we're on, you know, I got your back, Jack, right? So it's a little bit like that. Right? We're both mutually responsible here. We both have roles, and I got to look after you. You got to look after me. And at this period, I had to look after you. Maybe it would have been the reverse if something else happened, and you would have to, you know, but because sometimes we know they shoot the horses and they shoot the charioteer and you know, like that, and then they start hitting the real demon or the real person, right? So Pradyumna in that case would have to protect his charioteer, the one driving the chariot. It was part of his responsibility, not just to see to his protection, but to see that his horses and everything are protected. So in that case, he's expressing that both sides have to be, there's a duty on both sides. Yes.
These events have a lot of mysteries in them. Most of the past events were late. And to the modern or so-called modern people, they don't see mysteries. So there's the tendency to doubt, so much doubting. And then in the scientific circle also, they can't comprehend mysteries. And so they dismiss it as mythical. How, as a preacher, you can able to persuade them or can able to show them how these are actually done?
Well, it begins by us being convinced ourselves. That would be the first thing. But also Prabhupada brings a lot of strong philosophical points, you know. I mean, how, like I was mentioning, how great personalities like Rupa Goswami and so forth, that they didn't waste their time writing commentaries on these things. So that's one thing. And we also have to know that relying on the senses are imperfect, right? So there's agents that allow you, just like if there was no sunshine, then what can you see in the dark? So although you can see, but it's through a medium of something else that's assisting you to see. And even the objects that you're perceiving, just like a child, he sees, but what does he understand? And we know little children are always asking, you know, what is this, what is this? Because they want to know. They see all these things around them, but they don't know what they are. And then you might give names to them. This is a book, but that doesn't mean anything to him. He has to have more definition, more explanation that will help him appreciate what these things are. And then you have to have a value system to be able to judge things, you know, what are priorities in your life and what are secondary priorities in your life. And so all these things are there. So similarly, in Krishna consciousness, to try to understand things from just a direct sense perception is impossible. You have to have more depth understanding. And then when you have that depth understanding, then you can appreciate it for what it is. And Prabhupada did that for us. He gave us that depth understanding, you know. Like the impersonalists and the sahajas, Prabhupada always say, they run to the 10th canto because they think Krishna is some kind of playboy enjoying the gopis. But Prabhupada explained that that's not the case. Right? So when we understand these things, then we gain appreciation for the wealth of this knowledge. And just for someone to be able to write the Bhagavatam, and like you say, the intricacies and how one thing ties to another, and then this one in his previous birth was cursed, and that's how he became, all these different things. I mean, you really can't invent that stuff, right? I mean, you got to be a super genius to be able to just to invent all these things, and then it's just too big, right? Too vast of knowledge to just take it like that for granted, that just someone out of the blue wrote this. And for what purpose? You know, he's not going to make a movie out of this like today, right? Like, you know, Harry Potter and all these stupid things, Lord of the Ring and all that. I mean, they weren't writing just to make entertainment. They were writing to educate people, to purify people, you know. So Prabhupada didn't preach for entertainment, although these stories can be entertaining. But there's deep philosophical understanding that is meant to motivate the heart, to inspire us to work towards Krishna. You know? And by associating with these pastimes, just like when we associate together, what happens? You don't know the devotee, you start talking to him or the person, and then you start knowing a little bit, you start seeing things that are in common, and then you invite this person to your house or you do things, and then you become good buddies and best friends and right. But you didn't know the person from the beginning. It's just association. You became very attached. Right? So similarly, the more we associate with Krishna, in the beginning, who's Krishna? He's nobody to us, right? We're in such illusion. But as we associate with Krishna, we become attached to Krishna, and then we become in love with Krishna, and then we can't live without Krishna. And hopefully we'll become like the gopis, that when we blink and we don't see Krishna, we'll curse Brahma. Right? For having that subtle distraction, temporal distraction of not seeing Krishna for a split of a second. So this is what all this is aiming for. And as preachers, we have to somehow convey that message to the people we meet, how this is really extraordinary. And of course, not by jumping necessarily straight to these pastimes, but by giving the philosophy, you know, like Prabhupada did, we're not the body, and systematically showing the ABCs, and gradually they can come to that. But even way back in the beginning, I think probably in 66, 67, he's saying how it's not that we're going to hide Radharani. And he's telling this young girl that, and Krishna will come and he will kiss you. And everyone starts laughing, right? So it depends. Depends also on the submissiveness of the person. Right? I mean, I had difficulty in the beginning accepting this killing of Kamsa by Krishna. But after it was a little bit explained, I didn't have a problem after that. It was just, okay, great. God can do what he wants. So somehow, you know, by the Vaishnava's blessing, I was able to accept. And now I was just 17 years old. What could I understand? And I still don't understand anything today, but I'm trying to. But so that's also there. It's Krishna in the heart that inspires people. I mean, our preaching, we're talking, but ultimately, Krishna's in the heart and he sees this person's been praying for me for so long. So now I'll give him a break. I'll have him meet devotees. And and sometimes we do that. We meet people and we can feel it, that our you know, we're tapped, like things are coming or flowing and we're remembering things. And sometimes you meet people and it's like, it's just, you give example, it doesn't work, and it's like you're fumbling and tripping, and you know, and because the person's really not receptive, and Krishna's not allowing this person to make the connection. He's not allowing him to appreciate this philosophy. So it's also the person that we're preaching to, he has to be at a certain level of appreciation. Like that after many lifetimes when his knowledge comes and surrenders. So a person has to have a certain amount of appreciation. He has to want it, and then the preaching can go on. And if he's not inclined, then you give him prasadam, and you get purified. But how much can he really appreciate that? That might be a difficult thing. So, is there any other comments or questions? Or? So thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.